This is our Sabbath Bible study for the 30th day of the 5th month, and we're going to continue in the book of Ruth. This will be part 3. Anybody looking for the prior messages or other studies from Renewed Covenant Ministry, you can find them on renewedcovenantministry.com, and you can look at the Sabbath Bible study section as well as the audio ministries, and there are also plenty of other posts and pages that can be looked at for other subjects for those of you listening on the audio ministry right now. So we're going to pick back up. I'm not going to use a whole lot of time to explain what we read yesterday, because I was told after our service yesterday that I probably redundantly explained a little too much for most people. But, you know, I just want to make sure everybody is getting a grapple on what is being said here in the book of Ruth, and remind everyone of the context so that it flows evenly. So I apologize, and since we just had a message yesterday, it'll be fresh in our minds, whereas when we do one every week, it seems appropriate to remind those of us here, particularly, of what was talked about in the last week, and those who are listening to the MP3s can go back, I suppose, and listen, and then do it back-to-back if you want to. So I apologize for the redundancy, but it just seems appropriate sometimes. We're going to start out in one of the governing laws of the book of Ruth. As I pointed out yesterday, the book of Ruth is a book of common law. It's a book of much law that is being taught and the application of it in the society. So Leviticus chapter 25, and I'm going to start in 23. And it says, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. For ye are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession ye shall grant a redemption for the land. And if thy brother be waxen poor, and hath sold away some of his possession, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold." This is one of the operating laws or governing laws in the book of Ruth. This is what the whole book is primarily about. And as I had pointed out in the end of yesterday's message, it is also one of the laws that we spiritually see ramifications in as well. From a language standpoint, the word redeem in this verse in Leviticus is akin, which we're going to dwell on a little bit more emphatically. The word redeem and the word kinsman or kinsman redemption are always one word, the word gal. I'm not sure how you'd pronounce it for sure, but sometimes it's spelled in the Hebrew G-A-L, and sometimes it's spelled just G-L. All right, and the A is just a sound that you would hear in passing. So, nevertheless, this redemption, this kinsman redemption, is the story of the book of Ruth. It is used more in the book of Ruth, that word, than in any other book of the Bible, and as we've discussed, the book of Ruth is only the last 4 chapters of the book of Judges, so it's pretty unique in that way. Ruth chapter 3, verse 1. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? And now is not Boaz of our kindred, or is he not our redeemer?" It could say, "With whose maidens thou wast, behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash thyself therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man, until he shall have done eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lieth down, that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet, and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. And she said unto her, All that thou sayest unto me I will do." All right, so what we are seeing here is a pretty vibrant plot to get the man Boaz, the man of strength, interested in Ruth, is what we're seeing. We're seeing a very forward attempt to present herself as the subject of redemption. And this is definitely within the plan. So these people, these women, think that they have the right to do this. Now, something that should be thought about is, while under most circumstances, I think in a modest way, this would probably be pretty inappropriate for a woman to approach a man in this way. I think undoubtedly it would be an inappropriate way to go about things. In this case, however, because she is the subject of redemption, her and Naomi both are the subject of redemption, in a way they already belong to their kinsman redeemer. They just have not yet been officially redeemed. So perhaps in the women's mind, this is perfectly okay because they want to get to the point quickly. And so you hear the plot play out, and Ruth, wanting this, obviously, pretty fervently, tells her mother-in-law, whatever you tell me, I'm going to do. And I think what is interesting about Ruth's personality and character that we see throughout the story is that whatever Naomi tells her to do, she does. Okay, when she swore that oath to her, which I think is very interesting, because if you study particularly the Hebrew version of the oath that was made, where it starts out saying, where you die, I will die, and where you go, I will go, and your people will be my people, and so on and so forth. The word for making an oath is the word seba in the Hebrew. Okay, and we see that in particularly the Beersheba, the well of the oath, which is mentioned in the story of Hagar and Abraham. And whenever a person sevens themselves, which is the same word, where we get our word sabbath from, is from the same word, they seven themselves. They actually swear seven times. And in this particular story, I didn't notice this until reading it afterwards, that you can go through and recount all of the times that she sevened herself, all seven of the oaths that she makes, which is the literal meaning of the Hebrew word for making an oath, is to seven oneself. I thought that was incredibly interesting. So we can see the fervency of Ruth wanting to obey the words of her mother-in-law and wanting to be redeemed. And I think this is pretty important for the Christian life as well, as we consider the symbolic meaning behind the book of Ruth. I find that Paul's epistle to the Romans, when he's speaking to the Gentile Israelites that had been pruned off of the tree and grafted back on, he says, don't boast yourself against the branches lest you be, clipped off again. And so he is saying for us to fervently desire the root that we are connected to. And we can see this in the personality of Ruth. Ruth is fervently, zealously wanting to be part of the people of Israel. She pursues it in a way that we don't really read about in many other places in the scripture due to the storyline. So Ruth 3:6 goes on to say, she went down onto the floor and she did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, so in other words, he had become drunk, we see that Ruth then goes ahead and approaches. And I want to point out the statement here that's made. It says, uncovered his feet. Now that word is once again our focus word for this particular study, and that word is the Hebrew word gale. Alright? To uncover his feet is the same word. Alright, so this is the word I've already prior defined as kinsman and redemption. So what we are having here is another symbolic Hebrew poetic verse taking place. You would be reading this word over and over again if you were reading it in Hebrew. And you can find this particular usage of the word in H1540 if you want to look it up in a Strong's for easy reference. And it's the same as H1350. The words are indicative of each other. So in other words, they mean the same exact thing. There are just different usage of them. And Strong's divides them, which I disagree with Strong's division, because he takes oftentimes many Hebrew words that mean the same thing in different ways and divides them into sometimes 10 to 20 different words when they're actually spelled identical in the Hebrew. And that makes things confusing for those of us looking for the context and the meaning of a word. So I strongly recommend that anybody who's doing Hebrew study would start to pay attention to the Hebrew words and not just the Strong's numbers, because the numbers are great for us English reference people, but they actually help confuse the subject matter when you think they're different words when they're actually not. So in this case, once again, uncover his feet is the word gael, which is also the word for kinsman and also the word for redemption. So what Ruth is doing in 3:7, in verse 7 of chapter 3, is she's approaching him in a relationship fashion, and she uncovers his feet either from his blanket or from his skirt. And I'm going to say the context of what we're going to read on to is probably referring to the skirt. And that is indicative of redemption, all right? The marriage aspect of the redemption process is one and the same thing. They're connected in the Hebrew mindset and the culture of the day. Now, if you were to look in Leviticus chapter 18 and 20, when dealing with unlawful uncovering, that is the chapter where we read about who is you are not, or what it is that you are not allowed to uncover of near kinsfolk and things, sisters, mothers, fathers, you know, it defines incest basically, and tells us what is adultery and what is not adultery. If you were to look at that, it is the general word for that action, the action of uncovering, and it is forbidding us from galing, from gael, these particular people. It disallows it. The action of gael is not in the focus of uncovering or covering, as the word used in verse 9, in the phrase near kinsman, is again, it's gael. Alright? So the idea of the Hebrew logic is gathered up into the idea of kinship covering. And I believe it may be described by a particular, I find this very interesting, and I'm not going to try to assume too much, but I think it's pretty interesting, that it is described by a certain Gaelic custom of tartan, is what it's called. Most of us would know this from Scottish culture. Alright? And I don't think it should be too surprising that the Gauls, or the Gaelic people, also called Celts, may be seen in the exact wording of the Hebrew word gael. Alright? The tartan is these people's banner, or their standard. Alright? So the word gael is their family colors. Alright? It is the colors of their kinsmen. Alright? So when a Celtic man was to wear his kilt, which the K's and C's and G's are actually just one letter, he would be wearing the banner or the standard of his family. Now, this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I think it's interesting enough to tie it all together. You can as well see in the Bible, when the word banner and standard is used, the word degale. That is the capital letter D, G, and an L, all right, in the Hebrew, degale. You can see that in Strong's H1714. All right, so the standard or banner that a certain tribe or family would be carrying is called his degale. All right, and it is, for lack of a better term, his tartan or his banner, his standard of his family's cloth, which the men would wear in all functions of family life in both Celtic, the Celtic world, as well as in Hebrew world, where in the family life from birth, marriage, battle, death, the covering of the banner of their Gaelic family was upon them. All right, it was an important aspect of every part of their life, was the skirt that they wore. All right, I think that's incredibly interesting, because in the days of Ruth, the language indicates the same exact idea of that which was used by our less ancient Gaelic ancestors, for any of us who have that blood in us. It was an important part of Israelite society as well, to uncover a woman before you covered her, much as the depleting custom of women taking their husband's surnames nowadays, we could see the same function. All right? And I say depleting because we are living in a society where this doesn't happen as much, where a woman will take her husband's surname. In Scotland, or in the Gaelic world, in the Hebrew world, in the world of Ruth, they actually would take part of the banner, as part of their clothing. It was part of who they were. It was their symbol. All right. And in our modern day, we have still the leftovers of women taking men's last names upon themselves, which back in these days, there was no last name in the way that we use it now. You were just called the wife of so-and-so of the town of this and that, and maybe his occupation would be attached as well. But in this case here, what we see is a woman, Ruth, who wants to be covered, redeemed, made kin, by a man's skirt. All right, so she uncovers Boaz in a marital way in order to be covered by him. In other words, you could say she took off his blanket and laid down beside him, I think would be how we would think about it now. Because in these days, a man's tunic or his kilt was unstrapped oftentimes from off of his body with his belt, and he slept with it at night. It was made of wool, most likely, or of linen, or of some kind of warm fabric, depending on the time of the year. Probably at this time, he was wearing something made of linen on account of it being in the harvest time, so it was warm. All right? So when we read about this, we see a very closely connected word, gale, which indicates redemption, kinship, family, the family banner. Okay? All of this is talking about the uncovering, the same as what is forbidden for certain people in Leviticus chapters 18, 19, and 20. All right? So just as a background for that, once again. So in the days of the book of Ruth, the language would still indicate the same thing. And it was used by our less ancient ancestors, the Gauls or the Gaelics, which of course the book of Galatians is named after. It was an important part of Israelite society for a woman to be covered by her husband's banner or name, to be redeemed. All right. So I want to make sure that's tied in, so that when we think about, you know, our grandparents, who it was pretty common for those of us alive today in 2017, that our grandparents both had the same last name taken after the male. It's not as common anymore for this generation to be doing it, but it was a normal thing, and it's the same idea. It's the idea of what is called patriarchal headship, and it is the key to Israelite cultural heritage. It is the number one point of any law of God as it pertains to family culture, is the patriarch's heritage. That is what he passes on. That is what is being redeemed. That is what is the kinsman's laws are all about. The laws found on uncovering of nakedness and God's laws are regulations that promote the healthy growth of Israelite Christian culture. In other words, whenever God forbids something to be galed, to be uncovered, such as one's sister's mother, and so on and so forth, to close relation, as well as ethnic laws that we're talking about now and have been talking about, particularly in Deuteronomy chapter 23, where we are told that a Moabite and a Ammonite cannot enter into the congregation of Yahweh. We are just as well told in other places that Canaanites were not allowed to be galed by the people. They weren't to be married, to be covered by Israelite culture, by Israelite family name. Okay? So as we see this, what we'll call ethnic Israelite culture, we have the logic that inside of it is bound up in the law of headship. All right? The patriarchal headship is bound up in this, and the healthy culture is protected whenever God says you cannot redeem, make kin, cover this type of person, because I, God, don't allow, for whatever reason. That's his choice. All right, it is a protective clause built into God's law that disallows Israelites to destroy their children, their kin, by taking the wrong wives and the wrong husbands, for that matter. This is where the fathers rule their family by the fear of God, all right, by enforcing these types of laws. And this aspect of fear is as well seen in the accompanying language of the portion of the skirt This is also important as we get more into this story, and we'd already actually seen in the prior chapter. When we look at the portion of the skirt of covering, which is specified by Ruth. And that interesting point that's being mentioned is that which the Hebrew calls the kanaf, or the edge, the border. Now, if you remember correctly, yesterday, whenever I was talking about this particular verse in 2, it talks about Ruth being covered under the wings of Yahweh. He says that she has put her trust under the covering of Yahweh's wings. And I said, remember that word, all right? And that is the same Hebrew word, kanaf, all right, which is the edge, the border. All right, you may recognize it for those of us who remember this law and practice it. In Deuteronomy 22, chapter 22, verse 12, it says that there was a ribbon of blue that was to be a remembrance of Yahweh's law that would be hemmed into the border, the kanaf, the edge of one's skirt, the edge of their garment. All right, and that would be the reminder of Yahweh's law. So I find this incredibly interesting, and I'm drawing attention to it, because Boaz recognizes Ruth as coming under the edge, or the border, of Yahweh, all right, which is representative of the edge of the border of the skirt, which is covered for an Israelite in the blue thread, which reminds them of Yahweh's law. And ultimately, what Boaz was recognizing in Ruth, that she acted like an Israelite. She was acting like one of his people. She was helping her mother-in-law, that he says all the great things that she had done. And he recognizes her as being a good, lawful person, as being a good person, and that she was an honest, hard worker. So she came under the covering of Yahweh by her actions. He could tell by the way she acted that she was putting her trust in Yahweh. That's important. 3:8 goes on to say, it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid, and he turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, who art thou? Now remember, Boaz had had a little bit of drink. Most likely he was drinking some beer made of barley, which is, would have been pretty common for people to do at this time. And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Now notice how she identifies herself. She identifies herself as a handmaid, which, what did she say in the prior message? I am not like unto one of your handmaids. So what she's doing is she is putting herself in the place of a wife, is what she's doing. She is trying to become Boaz's wife. It's undoubtable by the language. And then she says this very provocative statement. She says, spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. That word, skirt, is once again the edge of the garment, the edge of his banner, his degale, his tartan, all right, his redemptive quality. And he said, blessed be thou of Yahweh, my daughter, for thou hast showed me more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. In other words, you're not looking on the beauty of a young man. Boaz is obviously an older man. He's obviously has other handmaids as well. And he's saying, you didn't look for some young man who's handsome, but you came to this old guy, basically, because I'm your redeemer. You know, you could have found any younger man to be with, but instead you wanted me because I am your redeemer. And that's how she approaches him. She says, spread your skirt over me because you are my near kinsman. All right. She is approaching him with the power of Yahweh's law and asking for his redemption quality, what he has, what right he has, or what she believes he has. And then he says in 11, he says, and now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest. For all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman. And here it is. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Uh-oh. So in other words, while Ruth is acting in a purely virtuous way, identified by Boaz. She doesn't have any lust in her heart, or she doesn't have anything incorrect about what she's doing. What she doesn't know, what her and Naomi have overlooked, was that there's actually someone who she belongs to. All right? As a redeemable person, there's somebody who has by rights, by God's law, the right to redeem you. And for anybody to damage that, it would be a form of adultery. Okay? It would be a form of fornication at the least, if it was argued that it's not a form of adultery. But she is redeemable to somebody else. Her and Naomi both. And Boaz knows this and recognizes it, so while he blesses her for doing the right thing, he says, listen, I can't do this. There's somebody else. So this is impossible for it to be a lawful union, for this to be a lawful marriage. We have to go about this the right way. There's a simplicity of godly truth that Boaz knew, we could say. And that despite the passion, despite the offer that Ruth is making, despite the allure, despite the fact that no one may have known what could have happened on this intoxicated harvest night except for Boaz and Ruth, and the justification that Boaz would most likely have by being the most likely redeemer of Ruth, and as such, there would have maybe been no repercussions. You could even say no one would have known this was a formerly married woman. It's Boaz. They're alone. It's the middle of the night. There's a lot of people drinking barley beer. And what's the repercussions for their actions if he were to cover Ruth with his skirt that night? Well, one repercussion would be that he wouldn't be able to publicly be able to have her as wife. Somebody else may challenge his right. And Boaz knew this. Rather, Boaz had the presence of mind, despite how much he may have drank or hadn't drank, which Paul teaches us very plainly in 2 Timothy 2:5. It says, if a man also strive for masteries, yet he is not crowned except he strive lawfully. Okay? And the law that I believe we could apply to that mindset here for Boaz, Boaz wants to strive lawfully. He wants to do the right thing. He wants to be crowned with Yahweh's reward by doing this thing the right way. And the law that we can apply to this verse in 2 Timothy 2:5 is Numbers chapter 27, and I'm going to start in verse 8. It says, and thou shalt speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man die and have no son, then ye shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter. And if ye have no daughter, then ye shall give his inheritance unto his brethren. And if his father have no brethren, then ye shall give his inheritance unto his kinsman, redeemer, that is next to him, and his father, and he shall possess it. And it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute of judgment, as Yahweh commanded Moses. So it is that despite the temptation that may be easily seen in the text, Boaz's passion for Yahweh's law overrides his lusts and even his rational judgment, which he could have easily rationalized this whole thing away, and he controlled himself on the matter instead. Something every one of us needs to identify with. Every man involved in any form of marital or non-marital activity needs to take a lesson from Boaz here. That rational judgment is the better option with Yahweh's law in mind. A rational judgment which could have easily disregarded Yahweh's law and Yahweh's word. Okay? So, Boaz knew Numbers chapter 27. He knew that there was a closer kinsman. There was somebody who had the right, and that was the law I was speaking of particularly. So Ruth 3:13 goes on to say, tarry this night, Boaz says, and it shall be in the morning that if he will perform unto thee the part of the kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of the kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of the kinsman to thee, as Yahweh liveth. Lie down until the morning. Okay, so he kind of takes Ruth and pacifies her and says, listen, we'll get this thing resolved. One way or the right thing's gonna happen for you. I'm gonna make sure of it. So you lay here until the morning. So what's he talking about, however, when he says the part of the kinsman? I believe what he's talking about is something which Yahweh's law also calls the duty of a husband's brother. Okay? The duty of a husband's brother. And this is found in Deuteronomy chapter 25. In verse 5, I'm going to pick up and read till 10, which says, starting in 5, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. Now this is the law which we spoke of in the first part of this book of Ruth, which I refer to as the law of the leveret, which is very easy to look up and find under that same name today. While it's not practiced by most people anymore, that's what it is referred to, the law of the leveret, which is the law of a husband's brother. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother, which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. All right? Now, the word put out is, I'm going to mention for a later reference. And the word put out is the Hebrew word mahi, okay? Mahi. And you can just as well see a Greek version of that if you're reading along in the Septuagint, which is ex alepho, all right? And which means literally to smear out or obliterate. All right, to smear out or obliterate, to blot out, to wipe away. All right, so when a person dies childless in Israel, in God's eyes, in Yahweh's law, he is put out. All right, cast out, removed, smudged away, and not remembered anymore. He's disremembered. In the Hebrew, it's H4229, if you want to look it up in your Strong's, and it is Mahi, is how I would pronounce it. Deuteronomy 25:7 goes on to say that if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate unto the elders and say, my husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Now, it's interesting how it always says husband's brother, you know, rather than just referring to the duty. But that's because in Yahweh's law, there is a specific word, and the word is best I could pronounce it, yabam. All right, yabam. And that is one term that is applied to this action. In other words, we say the law of the leveret. In Hebrew, it would be called the law of yabam, all right, which is the law of a husband's brother in the English. All right, so it's one action. He will not perform this function. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him, and if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off of his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who has his shoe loosed. There was another translation of the Bible called the Farrar Fenton, which I don't really recommend, but I always thought it was interesting in that particular translation when I was reading through it. He calls it a slipshod man, which is a term that used to be used to refer to somebody who's trying to get out of their obligation. He's slipshod. He's a slippery kind of guy. All right. In this case, what it's referring to specifically is a person who will not use his feet for what they are good for, what they're made for. And that all has a connection, once again, to our Hebrew word of focus, gael. All right? The word for kinsman, redeemer, skirt in some cases. All right? The word for the banner and the tartan that I was referring to. Well, whenever we are told that Ruth goes up to Boaz, what does she uncover? She uncovers his feet, right? And so, in this case here, we're talking about a person's feet who the shoe is removed from. The word gael is specifically referring to the part of a man's body that covers his feet, all right? It's referring to that particular function. So, this law of redemption has a lot to do with the feet. It has to do with the part of you that gets you from one place to another and gets you to do the things that need done. What I think is very important about that, and what is very interesting about it, is when we consider this in our symbolic sense, we hear about how beautiful are the feet upon the mountains that bring the tidings of the gospel, who bring the good news. We're talking about the people who are trying to redeem Israel, the people who are telling Israel their king reigns, according to Isaiah. All right? And so when we also read about the armor, the Christian armor that we're being given, in places we are told about shodding one's foot with the preparation of the gospel. All right? So we can see a great symbology in the shoe, in the foot, of this particular verse. And then it goes on to say in Ruth 3:14, which I think is incredibly important also, which I probably said that 1,000 times, so it's all pretty much incredibly important, according to Joshua. And she lay at his feet until morning. It makes another reference to feet. And she rose up before one could know another, before one could see each other, when it was yet dark, is what it's trying to say. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came into the floor. Also, he said, bring the veil that thou had upon thee and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. I was just reading in an alternative translation in a King James margin notes just last night, that in verse 15, when it talks about it, it says, he went into the city, in about 3 different translations of the Bible, referring to Boaz going into the city. But in our King James version and in the Masoretic Hebrew, it actually says she went into the city. I tend to believe that most likely it was he, and it was probably just overlooked. It seems like that would make sense considering what it goes on in 4 to say. 3:16 then says, when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, who art thou, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Then said she, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he has finished this thing this day. And that's why I believe it's referring to the he as Boaz and not as she, because it implies that he didn't wait around to go to town or to the city. He went immediately. And so what Naomi recognizes is this 6 measures of barley, I think the meaning of that is the reason it specifies it is once again the idea of the oath. The idea of the oath is when something is sevened. It's like a promise. All right? And she gives 6 measures of barley, in other words, saying this thing has not been completed yet. All right? This is not completed, but I'm giving you my word that I am going to finish this. Take these 6 measures of barley back to your mother. Don't return empty. And so I think that that is what that's implying. I'm not saying it's a hard, fast doctrine, but I think that's what it's implying. Ruth 4:1 then says, and when Boaz, then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside and sit down here. And he turned aside and he sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit ye down here. And they sat down. Now, Deuteronomy 16:18 says this, judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee, throughout thy tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment. So this is what we are being explained. This law was being kept. Boaz takes 10 of the elders, who are judges or officers, whatever he needs for this occasion, and he does as the law tells him. Accordingly, this law is the foundational structure of Israelite government. That is, the headship of the elders of old men. The judges were taken from the natural heads of the people with an officer, which could just as well be translated scribe. Matter of fact, in the Greek Septuagint, the word is grammatus, I think is how you say it, grammatus. And It means someone who is fluent in grammar, obviously. So it is a scribe. An officer is a scribe, and a judge is a judge. So they bring the appropriate men, who are the natural heads, which would be the elders, and they would have the knowledge in Yahweh's law. They would be honest and wise men that would be able to execute God's law properly in the way it needed to be done. These elders would have been the heads of the families and would have been naturally akin to Boaz, being that they lived in Bethlehem. Thus, they would sit at a literal gate of judgment, which would have been in the literal town of Bethlehem. It is where we, even in our modern day, get the idea of nexus, which is the threshold in which you pass into, most of the time in figments of our imaginations and jurisdiction in the court, but in a courtroom setting. But in this case, there were literal gates that you literally walked into, and your literal inheritance was bound to the jurisdiction of that literal place. All right, so these old men would have been the kinsmen. They would have naturally been related. They would have been old men that adjudicated for their own kinsmen. All right, so certain partialities in judgment just simply wouldn't exist due to the fact of where they lived. Ruth 4:3 says, "And he said unto the kinsman," or unto the redeemer, depending on how you want to define that word, "Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants, before the elders of my people," or our people, "if thou will redeem it," or if thou will be kinsman, "redeem it. But if thou will not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee." And he said, "I will redeem it," or "I will be kinsman." Then said Boaz, "What day," or it could easily be said in our modern English, "on what day that thou buy the field at the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance." Ruth 4:6 says, "And the kinsman," or the Gael, "said, I cannot redeem," Gael, "it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem, Gael, thou my right," which is then the word "my right" is the word Gaelath, "to thyself, for I cannot redeem it." The word Gael is used in this particular verse 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times to express this transaction. In other words, he is passing on the inheritance, the right of redemption, to the next man down. Okay. Now the phrase mar, which is the Hebrew word ashiyith, okay, which can come from your Strong's Concordance H 7843. Okay, the word mar is oftentimes something that is pointed out because people would like us to believe that Ruth being a Moabite, and then they also cite the law that they say was ignored in Deuteronomy, that's what he's referring to, the marring of his inheritance. However, if you were to look at Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 26, we read, "I prayed therefore unto Yahweh and said, O Lord Yahweh, destroy not thy people in thine inheritance which thou hast redeemed through thy greatness, which thou hast brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand." And the word "destroy" is the word "mar." Okay, so in this case is the only place I could find in the Bible specifically where both words, mar and inheritance, the two Hebrew words, are used. And in this case it says, "Destroy not your people, your inheritance, which you have purchased." Okay, and we're talking about a literal destruction here in this case in Deuteronomy 9:26. Judges 2:19 also says, referring back to Judges, it says, "It came to pass when the judges were dead," talking about how the treachery of Israel always going back as a dog to their vomit, it says, "when the judge was dead, that they returned and corrupted themselves more than their fathers in following other gods to serve them and to bow down unto them. They ceased not from their own doings, nor from their stubborn ways." The word corrupted here is the same Hebrew word, asheith. Okay, it's the same word that is used in the book of Ruth, and it is translated corrupted in this case. So we have destroy and corrupted to keep in mind as we understand the meaning of this verse, which we'll get into in a little bit, in just a little bit. Ruth 4:7 goes on to say, "Now this was the manner in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thyself. So he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witness this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day." I want to point out something out of Ruth 4:10 here. A name that I have not defined heretofore is the word Mahlon, which literally means to be sick or to be sickly. So Ruth's husband was Mahlon, or was sickness, right? This woman whom I have prior defined as a Benjamite removed to the land of Moab was married unto a sick husband. All right, Mahlon means sick in Hebrew. That's very important in the case that we are talking about, and you can find that in H 42:48. Also, when Boaz cites the law in saying that the name of the dead be not cut off, it is not the same Hebrew word as I prior described. It is Yakarath, which comes from H 37:72, if you want to look it up. And Yakarath means, literally, to cut something off. It means to, cut off, to destroy, to consume, very similarly. Specifically, in the words of a covenant, however, there is something more going on here, is what I'm trying to point out, that the word is most commonly being used to cut. I'm sorry, I said cut off a bunch of times. I shouldn't have said that. To cut, that it be not cut from among his brethren, and it says cut off in the English. Every time this word is used, for the most part, it is used in the talking of making a covenant, when a person cuts a covenant. So the words of Boaz doings are different in language, but they're the same in reasoning as Deuteronomy 25:6. And in the case of the letter of the law, it is to keep the name of the lineage. All right, so the point is to keep the lineage, not to let it be smudged out or smeared out, like the other verse said. Yet Boaz is a spiritual man, we have concluded, and as such it is evident that his expression as to the law, that is, that the name of the dead be not covenanted among his brethren. All right, this is contained in the idea of the language, and if we were to remember the name, Elimelech means God is my king, and Mahlon, the husband of Ruth, means sick. Thus, the symbolism of Christ's work is yet not lost, even in this part of the kinsman's redemption done by Boaz, who is the redeeming one of the line of his, he is the redeeming one of the line of his fallen brother Elimelech, and moving Ruth and her people back into the covenant of Israel despite the sickness which befell her and Naomi in the land of their captivity in Moab. So, in other words, there's a poetic connection that is present in the text of Ruth in this Hebrew, in the Hebrew also. And it's much complex to try to explain it to those who don't study Hebrew deeply. And it's also seen in the Greek whenever you look at the rhyme that is taking place throughout this entire chapter. quite a bit is more is going on here than I'm even able to explain to you, and that I even understand, quite frankly. But whenever we see the holistic aspect of this function, what I think is the most important part that I kind of fumbled up trying to explain here is that this karath that is taking place, this cutting, is actually a covenanting of him taking his ancestor, his fallen ancestor or relative's name. And that is the difference in the two laws whenever you actually look at the law of the kinsman redeemer, or the law of Yabam, the leveret. When a man is marrying a fallen brother's wife in order to raise up seed unto his name, that it be not smudged out or it be not erased. The difference is the way that Elimelech is phrasing it is not that it be not cut off, but rather that it is not uncovenanted, all right? That the covenant relationship is not lost. And I think that's important because of the covenantal matters of Ruth. I also think it's interesting, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring up the two verses I found on Deuteronomy 9:26 and Judges 2:19, where it says destroy and corrupted, referring to the same word, is because both of them are referring to Israel in a state of rebellion. Both of them are referring to God's heritage being lost, the covenant being broken, and Moses in Deuteronomy is pleading, and the writer of Judges is explaining how they corrupt themselves by following other gods and going in other ways contrary to God's law. All right? So because of that, I think that what we can say is that the marring of the inheritance that is being talked about by the kinsman, he will not marry Ruth on account of the marring of his inheritance, is probably because of who Ruth is, not because she's a Moabite necessarily, but because she is from an outcast people from the land of Moab, all right? The strange gods that are present in the land of Moab, as well as the strange doings of the people of Benjamin, regardless of how you want to look at it, it is pretty much one and the same situation, as I had expressed in who Ruth's God may have been or may not have been in one of the prior sections. And so I wish I could make this a little bit more clear whenever I'm trying to explain this function of Ruth and what Boaz is doing with the name of his fallen brother, his sick fallen brother, and his uncle or great uncle or whoever it is, Elimelech. Ruth 4:11 goes on to say, and all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. So the shoe was slipped off, and I'm not going to go in deeply because most people go into it, but there is an aspect of the law found in Deuteronomy that is being neglected, and that is the spitting of the face is not happening. All right? Only the shoe is taken off, and I can't exactly explain why that is. I would guess one is a symbol of shame and one is not. And so for whatever reason, maybe that spitting only happened whenever a person had no one to redeem them, when a woman was unable to be redeemed, and it was such a horrible thing to happen to her that was her right to spit in his face. But in this case, since there was another redeemer present who would do the job, it only was a shoe transfer. Okay. But it says, we are witnesses, Yahweh, make the woman that is come into thine house like Rachel and Leah, which two did build the house of Israel, and do thou worthily in Ephratah, and be famous in Bethlehem, and let thy house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bare to Judah, of the seed which Yahweh shall give thee of this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went in unto her, Yahweh gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the woman said unto Naomi, blessed be Yahweh, which has not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life, and a nourisher of thine old age, for thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than seven sons, has bore him. And Naomi took the child, and laid it in her bosom, and became nurse unto it. And the woman, this I find is interesting, and the woman, her neighbors, gave it a name. It's kind of an odd way to say that, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed, for he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now the word Obed, interestingly enough, means servant. And then we have the genealogy of David. Now these are the generations of Phares. Phares begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Abinadab. Abinadab begat Nashon. Nashon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David, of course, who became king in Israel. With this story in mind, consider the context I've been really trying to push in this book of Ruth as we finish it up. I'm going to take a little bit of time in trying to finish up the symbolic and the new covenant meaning of this, the new covenant, because all covenants, as I said, are cut. And when a covenant is cut, it is made, and we know that our new covenant was cut in the blood of Christ. So there is a symbology that runs even deeper to this, and I've been trying to push it as much as I can in this message onto the Gentile Israelites that had been redeemed by the blood of Christ, and the story that Hosea gives us, as well as Paul gives us in the book of Romans. So let's turn to the book of Romans, chapter 6, and finishing some of this up, where Paul the Benjamite, who is an apostle to the Gentiles, says, know ye not that to whom you... Now remember the meanings of the words. To whom you yield yourself servant to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death, or of obedience unto righteousness. Now remember the meaning of Ruth's husband's name. What was it? Sickness. Right? Sickness. And sickness led to death. But God be thanked that you were the servants of sin, but that you have obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered you. Being then made free from sin, you have become the servants of righteousness. I speak after the manner of men because of the infirmity of your flesh, for as you have yielded yourself members, servants to uncleanness, and unto iniquity, even so now yield your members, servants to righteousness unto holiness. For when you were the servants of sin, you were free from righteousness. Now listen to this. This all is marriage language from this point forward. What fruit had you in those things whereof you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. But now, being made free from sin and become the servants of God, you have your fruit, which is your children, unto holiness, and the end, everlasting life. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Yeshua the Christ our Lord. 7 goes on to say, know ye not, brethren, for I speak to them who know the law, how that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives? For the woman which hath a husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband liveth she be married to another man, she would be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from the law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married unto another man. Wherefore, my brethren, ye also are become dead to the law by the body of Christ, that you should be married to another, even to him who is raised from the dead, that we should bring forth fruit unto God. For when we were in the flesh, the motions of sin, which were by the law, did work in our members to bring forth death. But now we are delivered from the law, that being dead wherein we were held, that we should serve in the newness of spirit, and not in the oldness of the letter. The redemptive power of Christ that I'm trying to point out is present in this particular summarization, I believe, of the book of Ruth, where we even are referencing laws of marriage that pertain to Ruth pretty amazingly. And if that's not the theme of the story of Ruth and the end of the book of Judges, I'm not exactly sure what is, because the book of Judges is rife with rebellion in Israel, corruption in Israel, the inheritance of Israel becoming corrupted. Redeemed by the blood of the Lamb as the seed of Israel, we are kinsmen redeemed. Ruth, the friend, the outcast of the removed Benjamites, was called to be the wife of a sick son, a son of God, the king, And in the removed land of Moab, there was no rest found for her, we're told, or for her pleasant mother-in-law. Yet after the death of her sick husband, she bound herself to the pleasant remnant that only had a thread left that connected her to the people of Israel, her only thread, and to the inheritance of the people in Israel. Ruth humbled herself as a servant to Naomi and worked out her salvation with fear and trembling before her forefathers and her Lord. I'm sorry, not before her forefathers, but before the forefather of our Lord and Christ, because she knew that he was her Redeemer. I think that that is present in the text and present in the mention of the seed of life that is mentioned as coming out of Ruth, and that she would bring redemption to Naomi, to the pleasant, and redemption to herself. In her humility, in Ruth's humility and zeal, she receives the reward of her womb. And by her womb, we are told, was the seed given, who was a restorer of life. And that son, the neighbors called the servant, the servant who is the son of strength. That would be Boaz. So as we reflect upon the book of Ruth and we finish it up here, I really think that we as Christians reading the book of Ruth, and I think very few Christians even read the book of Ruth for what it was meant to be read for, in coupling that idea with what we are taught in the book of Romans, particularly in 6 and 7, and looking at it from the aspect of Boaz being a redeemer of God's covenant, not just a redeemer of a woman or of a widow, but a redeemer of his people, his Israelite people, that we can see in the life of Boaz, in the strength of Boaz as he lives according to the Spirit and not according to the oldness of the letter, that we can find in ourselves also the ability to identify ourselves with Ruth and her struggles, because as she was called a virtuous woman, which I think if anyone were want to know the strict definition of that biblically, they could go and read Proverbs chapter 31, which I'm not going to read here. But it basically tells us of what to look for in that type of person, and Ruth is identified as one of those people, as a virtuous woman. And so that's something that every Christian, I think, every person who's trying to strive towards the law and the grace of God, that's trying to learn something from the blood of Christ and apply it to themselves, should probably go back and take a good hard look at the life of Ruth, the outcast, the removed Ruth, who sought so fervently to be a member of the kingdom of Israel, or the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, that she was willing to put herself down on her face, bow down to a man that she had never met before, who was said to be her kinsman redeemer by a law that she may or may not have known very well, and that she bound herself to a woman who she had no good reason to, unlike her sister-in-law, Orpah, that went right back to the people that she had come from because she didn't see the hope offered in being under the wings of the God of Israel. So as we consider all of these things and we see the beauty of Yahweh's law and the manifestation that can come out of it, all the case law and example that we've covered in these three parts of the book of Ruth, I hope that not only does it show us a symbolic place of repentance, but it also shows us the greatness of what it would be like if we were to put ourselves under the law of God and we were to turn our society over to the laws of God in the way that God wanted us to, that we wouldn't be like the corrupted ancestors of ours out of the book of Judges and the corrupted ancestors of some of us, the Benjamites, that they forsook God and died in their sins because they were the servants of sin, and that rather we would become the servants of righteousness, more like Ruth, and that we would live after the spirit of the law and not after the letter, which kills.